At the end of the day, the testing is important, but being able to identify risks early in the process and point them out or test them to make sure that we don't hit those risks, that's even more important to me.
Welcome to the PeopleStack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk, founder of Jen Bunk Ventures and architect of the PeopleStack. My guest for this episode is Joe Yuska. He is Senior QA Manager at OneDoor. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited to chat. So let's talk about what you do at OneDoor. What does it mean to be a Senior QA Manager there?
So I manage a team of QA engineers, both here and we also have an offshore, nearshore team in South America. I work directly for the CTO. I work with the vice president of engineering and with the scrum masters and our project managers and product group. And we are responsible for testing, for managing releases, and a great deal of the quality process that goes on in our software development. Not just the testing, but also helping to review stories. I manage and run the bug triage system we have in the company, and we also have started doing more story review with our product and our UX folks.
Okay. So for those folks who may not have a technical background and may not know what a story review is or what quality process is, can you explain it to someone who may not have ever worked for a tech company or maybe doesn't know what QA is or wants to know a little bit more about that?
Sure. So when I talk about stories, when we're developing our software, so our software is used by retail stores to manage their merchandising displays and distribution of product to their stores, and the store managers then use our software to find out how to set it all up and merchandise it, lay it out on the floor. So when you see the big displays that are the same, if you go to a store at here in Boston, or you go up to New Hampshire, you see basically these same layouts, and it's all that's done by their home office and then distributed through our software. When we add features to that, it's generally done in software through the use of what we call a story that says, as a user, I want to be able to push a button and send an email confirming my receipt of this product. That's a basic story. So then the product team then fleshes that out a little more. The product management team fleshes that out a little more, puts a little bit of design behind it, and then engineering goes in and makes parts of the software that will then do that and actually implements this story.
Yeah.
Where I come in and my team comes in is, when the software is written by the developers, we go in and we test it. And we don't just make sure that, yes, I pushed the button and the email is sent. There's a lot of other things behind it, but also make sure it's not breaking other things around it. Like, I'm sure you've used software before where a new feature comes in and it broke an old thing you used to love to use.
Yeah.
That's called a regression. And so we test to make sure those don't happen as well. So we're making sure that... We make sure that the software that we send to the customers is the quality that we want to be giving to our paying customers.
Okay.
Where it's doing what it's supposed to, and the new things do what they're supposed to, but we also make sure that the old things still work.
Okay.
On top of that, we also make sure that a consistent process is followed and everybody's on the same page from end to end. And that's more of what I'm trying to bring more to the company that hasn't been there before, is this kind of a process.
Okay. All right. So that's kind of the big picture overview. That's your responsibility. Mm-hmm. That's what you're helping the company do, helping the customers mm-hmm. to do. But on a day-to-day basis, what is your day? Is there a typical day? Does that exist?
No, there isn't. So generally my mornings, I come in, I will sometimes attend some of the project team meetings that happen in the morning, the different status meetings. I usually catch up with some of my team. I have, 5 engineers here in Boston. I have 4 in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And we use Slack to communicate with them. So I'll do a catch up type of thing. I'll take a look at the bugs that have been filed, some of the tasks ahead of the team for the day.
Yeah.
So it's a little chaotic in the morning. There's a lot of different things of that. And then the rest of the day is sometimes I have some testing projects I'm working on. I have meetings with other managers as we're starting to do some of the early stages of other projects. But also a lot of the rest of the day is kind of improvising my way through of making sure my team is getting what they need, or they're working on the right things, or the ship steering that goes on.
Sure.
And it's going to vary day to day. The only day that's consistent at all is Thursdays, and that's when I'm in all the meetings all day.
meetings, morning, one-on-ones, afternoons.
Everything is all clustered on a Thursday.
Okay, and you do that on purpose?
Partly by design. Partly because I have a couple of folks on my team that have, because of certain family commitments, they have scheduled work from home days. Yeah. So Thursday is a good common day to get everybody in so I can just go down the list.
Okay, got it. And you mentioned that sometimes there's a testing process that you're involved in. Does that mean you get in the weeds sometimes?
Yes, there are times. I don't as much as I used to. I probably could get away with not doing it at all, but I wouldn't enjoy that as much.
Okay.
I still want to be able to do some of these things. I will be the lead QA on a couple of the smaller projects that mm-hmm. don't require a full-time person in there, but I still get in there and dig around and tinker.
Okay.
And there's also a lot of test case reviews I have to do. So If I'm not familiar with the software and the actual testing itself, that can get away from me.
Okay. So I can appreciate that and I can understand that. Like, but would it be possible to be a QA manager without getting into the weeds?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it is possible. I don't want to do that. And I have done it, especially here at One Door, a few times.
Mm-hmm.
There are times that I feel that I'm not serving myself the best I can without doing, and it's not a full-time project. I don't do a lot of the day-to-day, there are weeks that'll go by without me doing much testing at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I still want to be able to keep my chops up.
Okay. Because that's your background, right? That's where you started.
Right. Well, That's where I started in technology.
Right. Yeah. So that's actually what I wanted to talk about is mm-hmm. that in some ways you have kind of a linear path because you started out as in QA as an a QA
so
individual
a
contributor.
QA technician
yeah.
At Bay Networks in Billerica. Mm-hmm. That was mid-90s. I started there.
Mm-hmm.
So I come from a family of computer engineers. My father worked at Raytheon in the late 60s and early 70s. He was a physics major and got recruited to write trajectory software for Raytheon.
Uh-huh.
There's supposedly still some of his code running in the Patriot missile systems.
Wow.
Which is kind of interesting. So I grew up, I'm one of the few people I know of my age range that will just leave it as my age range that does not remember not having a computer in the house.
Okay.
We had the old acoustic coupler modems. My dad had terminals where you would take the receiver of the phone, you would dial up as soon as you heard the modem noise.
Yeah.
You would jam the phone receiver into these two acoustic rubber cups, and that would be the that was the modem.
So oh,
the
so old not modem even noise, War Games. I was thinking War Games. You know, with the in the, yeah, in the it, movie where you put the phone on the
that's
thing.
Exactly that oh, was that's, exactly it. That, and, okay. And you would put it in that, and those are rubber soundproof cups. And there's foam and there's rubber in those, and you would jam the phone in there as soon as you heard the whistling noise.
Okay.
And you know, you were hosed if somebody else picked up one of the other lines in the house.
Oh yeah.
Because it broke the connection.
I remember that, but yeah, we didn't have to do the soundproof cuff
yeah,
thing.
Later on you had the ones with the modular that just plugged into the phone lines.
Yeah,
and you didn't
right.
do that.
But, exactly.
So I grew up with all this technology, and I was tinkering and hacking things, and even doing little electronics projects. And I was on bulletin board systems when I was in eighth grade and things like that.
Yeah.
But I did not want to get into technology. I did not want to be in the computers at all. I fought against it.
Because your family, that's
because
what your
family
did.
Business,
you wanted it to
and
be
I had
fun.
No interest to do it because it was just, okay, that's what Dad did, whatever. And my uncles were the same way. It was like, okay, that's computers, fine. Ooh. Instead, I went into broadcasting. I went to Boston College, studied communications, worked for several years as a editor, producer, did some on-screen talent, but most of the stuff I did was directing, directing TV shows, live productions, especially multi-camera live. And I'm the guy sitting in the truck behind all those big banks of monitors, yeah, calling, okay, take two, take three. Mm-hmm. So that was me for a long time.
Yeah.
It didn't really pay well, I'll be honest.
Okay.
I was living in Quincy, and I was managing a station, program director for a station on Cape Cod in Mashpee. So I was commuting from Quincy to Mashpee, which was 74 miles each way.
Yeah.
And I was, I'll even, it's been 20 something years. I can say I was making about 28.5 based mm-hmm. on that. And, I had just gotten married. We were thinking of maybe having kids, things like that. And
right.
even with freelance stuff on the side, it wasn't paying much. So I decided to, there was also, it's also a very political business and I don't have patience for that, which helps shape how I deal with tech as well. I don't have patience to play the political games. And so I wanted to get out of broadcasting. So I thought I would get into marketing. During the 90s, a big thing was internal companies making internal training videos and films. So you know, like you'd start a job and you'd have to sit in the manager's office and watch videotapes of
yeah.
how to do your daily tasks in yep. the company.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually pretty lucrative at the time. Mm-hmm. So I sent a resume in, and in broadcasting, you don't do interviews. So I had never done a job interview in that
okay.
regard. You don't, so you'd send a portfolio of your work, and you might meet with one person,
mm-hmm.
and that's when they decide
and
based
they
on
just
your
say,
portfolio of
you're
work.
In or you're, out.
Yeah, come on in, you're hired.
Yeah.
I had never done that. So my uncle, who I, as I mentioned, was in the software business. He had a friend who was working at Bay Networks. And they were expanding. They were in Billerica. They were expanding like crazy. They had gotten a whole bunch of new business. And they were hiring for their marketing and internal communications department. So I'm like, fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote up my resume, gave it to him. He gave it to his friend who was this guy was sort of a pioneer developer of early internet protocols. I don't know if you're familiar with RFCs, but basically they're the documents that define how parts of the internet work.
RFC stands for?
Actually, it's request for comment. Okay. But they would publish this out there, kind of like in like a scientific paper, putting it out for
oh,
review.
Okay. Yeah.
And then everybody says, yeah, let's do it like that. And that becomes the standard of how things operate.
Okay, yep.
He had written like six of these. This guy was a serious hardcore protocol, data communication, super low-level developer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had no idea what he did, but it was sounded cool. They wanted me to come in for an interview for the thing. So mm-hmm. I talked with somebody in HR, and they said, yep, come on in. You'll be meeting with these people. It'll be great. I get there on the day and they said, actually, you're going to be meeting in building 7. Okay, I'll go over to building 7. I go in and I sit down and this tall guy comes in and we start talking, and about 3 or 4 minutes into the interview, we realize this is a huge mistake. They slated me to interview with my uncle's friends group, the developers group. This was the lead developer and the dev manager for this group. And he's like, all right, there was a huge mistake here.
Yeah.
But he actually, because of all the trouble, he bought me lunch. So we started talking about technology. I started doing some of the things that I used to do and hack around with.
Yeah.
And he's like, so you just like to tinker with the stuff? I said, yeah, I'm a user. I tinker with things. I don't have patience for programming. I've tried it. It's just not my thing.
Right.
He goes, okay, come meet this guy. So he introduced me to the director of QA.
Yeah.
And they had me come back in 2 weeks later, and I interviewed there. And he said, okay, so we'd like to give you a job. It's super entry level. It's a QA technician. You're not an engineer. But we'd love to have you come in and start to have you get in with the group. Unfortunately, all we can do for this right now is 36.9.
Right.
I'm like, okay, I guess I can deal with that. and I've stayed with it ever since. So I was an engineer there for a little while. I left. They were bought by Nortel. We got absorbed into another company that Nortel had already owned. That became a lot less of a positive experience. It was not a good assimilation. And the manager I had at that point, he didn't like the new people being brought in from the other company. He resented us in a way. So he was really hard on us unnecessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking around and got a job. I worked with Groove Networks for a while. Worked there for a few years.
As a QA
So I started engineer. As a QA engineer there. Mm-hmm. Over the time at Nortel, I did eventually become a QA engineer.
Yeah.
And then when I moved over to Groove, I was a QA engineer there for about a year, and then they bumped me up to senior QA engineer.
Okay.
And we were sort of this weird off-the-side group that only did protocols and communications. We had our own lab. We were off in the corner. We were the troublemakers. but we were really good at it. And so when we expanded our customer base, I moved over to support. I became the tier 3 escalation support person because I was pretty good at determining sort of reverse engineering customer problems and replicating the problem. So it worked out well.
Sure.
They were bought by Microsoft. And then I went through a couple of other tech companies that did sports software. I did a music distribution service called Ruckus. Then I joined Blue State Digital, which was the most amazing experience of my career. We did a lot of work with political candidates. It was founded by the leaders of the Howard Dean campaign.
Yeah.
And we made software for political campaigns. And our biggest success was, in fact, Barack Obama in 2008.
Wow. Okay.
And then I started there in 2009 when they realized they needed to have QA. So I was,
okay.
They hired a QA manager, and then I was the first engineer hired there. I stayed there for about 7 years, and that's when I ended up becoming into management after a while.
Okay.
And then from there, I left there about 3 years ago and then came onto One Door about 2.5 years ago.
Okay. Got it. And just out of curiosity, what kind of software would a political campaign need?
So
you don't have to reveal any super deep dark circus.
No. This is the part where a fair amount of your audience is going to go, oh, he's that guy. So our company made the tools that political campaigns would use on their websites to do outreach to constituents, outreach to voters. Did you ever get one of those things, sort of log on to barackobama.com and sign the petition to do things, and you put your name in, and then you started getting emails from the campaign?
Okay, yeah.
that was our software. And so mm-hmm. we would process the donations. You'd plug it in, you'd do your credit card, we'd process the donation.
Yeah.
And so a lot of campaigns, that can be expensive
sure.
for a campaign to do that. So we provided those tools for the websites.
Okay.
And then the part that I worked on a lot was our mass mailer system.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got an email, if you got emails from BarackObama.com, you got emails from Senator Warren's campaign, you got emails from the DNC,
mm-hmm.
Those came through our servers, and I made sure that those sent out a lot of personalized email and sent it out as accurately as possible.
Okay.
So that's where a lot of people are going to go, oh, he's that guy. I got to say, that was the most amazing time in my life, though, because I got to go out to Chicago to the headquarters in 2012. I got to attend the inauguration. My family got a private tour of the West Wing.
That's so cool.
My son has a story about going to the bathroom in the president's bathroom outside the Oval Office. you know, there's all these different things. It was just, it was an incredible experience. It was the most challenging and hectic time, though.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at like crazy times now at One Door, and I'm like, oh, this is so that's nice.
Nothing.
So relaxing.
Nothing compared to that. Yeah. And you said that's when you moved into management. So you
yes.
moved into management while you were working for Blue State
yes.
Digital.
Okay. The woman that hired me was the QA manager that was hired. She took over a development team.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hemmed and hawed. So I did not want to be management. As a matter of fact, she's to this day, we're still close friends. To this day, she still gives me a hard time about, so when we were interviewing, you said you didn't want to be management, huh?
Hmm? right, exactly.
I took over the team, though. We decided it was best for us to keep it internal. I was looking for a little change anyway. And I am not a trusting person in the sense of having somebody come in from the outside during this crazy time as we're ramping up to get ready for the re-election campaign.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, I'm just going to do this.
Yep.
And as it turns out, I'm not bad at it.
Mm-hmm.
I was in scouts as a kid. I'm an Eagle Scout. I did all these different things. I've been a scout leader for my kids' groups.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been in some sort of leadership or some sort of organizational role.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, I'll do this one.
Mm-hmm.
And that shapes a lot of my management style too, is I'm going to toss somebody in the deep end and let's see how they do. And I'll keep the rope handy, but
sure.
I want them to do it themselves and find their own ways to do it. And I guide that.
Okay.
So, and when you're talking about campaign development, you know, a project that a normal software company would take 6 months to develop, we had to do in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot of room for handholding. There's no room for micromanagement, which I hate anyway.
Right.
It's one of the reasons I left Nortel in the first place was that kind of approach.
Mm-hmm.
So, it worked out. It worked out well.
Right, because you guys, you had to get stuff done, and you had to
get
it done quickly.
We had to get it fast,
yeah,
and deal with very, very cranky, surly clients who are feeling all kinds of pressure because they're in the middle of a very high pressure environment themselves.
Yeah, right.
So, it was an interesting transition for me, and that's where I learned I had to let go with a lot of the day to day stuff too, though.
Yeah. Right.
And especially with that compressed schedule, there's no way you can do both.
Right. Exactly.
So
yeah, you got to let the people who know who are experts mm-hmm. at that do their thing.
Right.
And you're there to guide them. You're there to
steer the absolute best. The absolute best boss I ever had. Two pieces of advice that I've always kept with me. One was from my best boss. One was from my absolute worst boss ever. You know, the broken clock rule apparently worked with him.
There you go.
My best boss ever told me, you hire people smarter than you, you stay out of their way, and you make sure that they can get their job done.
Right.
That's your job.
Yes.
And I've tried to hold to that as much as I can.
Yeah.
Which, oddly enough, is not super common, it seems.
It's hard to do,
yeah.
Especially when you have that background of I've done this before and I know how to do this. It's like to not just step in and say,
right.
I could fix it. But to just say, I'm going right. to throw you in the deep end.
And a lot of QA especially is about, to be successful in a QA organization, you have to have personal credibility.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, your job is to go up to somebody, point out the mistakes they made, tell them they suck, and have them say, hey, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Not easy to do.
Right.
Or to be able to come up with somebody and say, you're doing this the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times where, especially when I'm first working with a group, I will say something, I won't press the issue, and unless it's like super critical, obviously. But if it's something that this can work on, as I will let it go and I'll say, okay, so remember how I said this the first time. Now we have to do it this way. We should really do it this way.
Right.
And build up your credibility that way.
Right.
You can't do that as a QA engineer if your boss is constantly looking over your shoulder or intervening or doing things in your place. You have to do that yourself.
Yeah.
So that's where I try to grow the team into doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, in fact, that's one of the things I'm really trying hard to do is there's a team that I have, a very talented team. These guys are fantastic. There are some of them, though, that just don't have that as their natural personality tendency. They don't have that nice confrontational thing, and they don't have that credibility. So that's what one of the things I'm trying to develop with the team is to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a huge part of it. And that's where I rely back on a lot of the external leadership experience I have, is that's how, for example, Boy Scouts work, is you do that. You do exactly that. You say, okay, here's your tent. Off you go.
Yeah, right. You know, right.
So.
Real world leadership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Cool. Hey there, folks. We'll get back to the interview in a flash. But first, do you identify as a technical manager? Do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you want to achieve career transformation? If you want to know what it really takes to upgrade your team, your career, your paychecks, and your life, then look no further for your tribe. My Facebook group exists to help tech managers command premium salaries of at least $200,000 a year without working their butts off 50 plus hours a week. We have very valuable conversations about what it takes to upgrade your career in the technical leadership space. You'll learn more just by hanging out in the group than you would by reading hundreds of books and attending tons of workshops. If this sounds valuable to you, then go to genbunk.com/Facebook to join us today. You'll connect with other tech leaders who want to achieve massive success in their careers. That's genbunk.com/Facebook. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview. So I wanted to talk more about QA.
Sure.
And just to sort of understand that a little bit more.
Because, yeah, I like talking about myself.
Because, I mean, in your role in,
right,
in QA and what you see as how it's different, what some myths that might be squashed. But actually, one of the things that I was thinking about as you were talking, Joe, was what would be the difference between, say, a QA engineer and a software engineer? Like, because it sounds like from, okay, I'm going to explain it the way that I think,
mm-hmm,
it works.
No,
and then you,
sorry,
could just tell me I'm
absolutely
completely wrong. Okay. So like, to me, the software engineer, they're the ones who write the code, and maybe they do some testing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe hopefully they do some testing, but with the QA engineer, it's not as much writing the code and creating it from scratch, but it's doing all the testing and
sure,
reading through it. So you have to know the syntax of the code, right? Like, you have to be familiar with it or not.
It
I guess that's where I get confused.
That part doesn't always matter.
The knowing the syntax,
yes,
of the code?
That,
okay,
part is not always, and sometimes that's a detriment.
Huh, okay.
So this goes back to the broken clock rule of what my worst boss ever said. QA's role ultimately is to be able to report on and give an accurate report of the quality of the product at any stage during its life cycle. So testing is a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And testing is where you gather the data to be able to assess the quality of the product. To get back to what your original question was, the difference between is actually, I think of it a little more abstractly. A software developer solves a problem. is given a problem and tries to come up with a solution for it. So the problem is I can't push a button and send an email to confirm receipt of my product. Mm-hmm. So the developer goes in and they will go in and they will solve that problem. Mm-hmm. The QA person knows that, but also makes sure that QA, I split QA into two groups. There's the role of QA is QA, quality assurance, and QC, quality control. Quality control is the testing and the putting the stamp in to say it's done. The inspected by number 11 in your pack of Hanes underwear mm-hmm. is quality control. Mm-hmm. We did this the right way. Quality assurance is we are going to and we are doing this the right way. So you're setting up your process. You're making sure that things are following a certain repeatable process, a pattern, a consistent process. A large part of the mistakes that happen in software development don't come from a developer being a bad coder or making a lot of mistakes in mm-hmm. their code. It comes from a lot of developers doing their thing in a code base and stepping on each other.
Yeah.
Or conflicts or that sort of thing. I like my QA team to have a breadth of knowledge of the product.
Mm-hmm.
I want my team to be able to know how to do everything and how things work across the product. I don't expect them to have the deep dive. And that's where the code part comes in is.
Yeah.
I'm not super interested if one of my engineers takes the code and she dives into it to find out to make sure that the developer wrote it the right way.
Right.
I actually don't care about that. That's what code reviews are for.
Right.
That's what the developer's process is for.
Okay.
What I want to make sure of is that it's in there the right way, it does what it's supposed to, and doesn't break things around it. And earlier in the process, the QA part is being there during the estimation process and the initial design and say, we have to make sure that this isn't going to affect that because a lot of times a developer who's focused on a single area might not realize that somebody over in that group is also touching this, so it's going to affect their work.
Sure.
We would know that because we're not following a single area. We're on different areas of the product.
Yeah, okay.
So that's the real difference there. Mm-hmm. And some of the best QA engineers I know are not computer science people, are not programmers. The absolute best one, and she will kill me if she ever hears this, absolute best QA engineer I've ever worked with, and given the right budget, I will steal her in a moment as soon as I can, was a marine biologist.
Yeah.
Went out and counted fish on the fishing fleets to make sure that quotas were met and the things were being done the right way, things like that. But what she does, she has that ability to see the breadth, see the larger picture, and be able to point out the flaws and the risks. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, the testing is important, but being able to identify risks early in the process and point them out or test them to make sure that we don't hit those risks, that's even more important to me.
Okay. That's super helpful that for me, right. And I know that other people are going to find that.
That attitude is becoming rarer, a lot more rare in technology, though.
Yeah.
As you're looking at more moves to automation, which I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
So there's a great deal of value in automated testing. There's an equal value in having somebody be able to sit there and go, how am I going to break this?
Yeah.
there's another difference. A developer will sit there and say, here's how it's supposed to be done.
Yeah.
If I have somebody who's not a technologist come in, they'll sit there and go, all right, so I'm a dumb customer.
Yes.
Or I'm the customer who grabs the software, doesn't look at the manual, and just starts pushing things to see what happens.
Exactly.
If they start doing that and it blows up, you're going to lose that customer.
Right.
We will go in and do that. You can't do that with automation. You don't get that ability with that. So I like to have a nice mix of manual and automation.
Okay.
Automation takes care of the really boring tasks that absolutely have to be done.
Sure. But there's certain things that only a human brain can come up with.
Right.
Like, what convoluted set of things
can somebody do? You also can't automate development of, for example, a web app while you're still developing it. You can't automate it because you don't know what it's going to be doing or how to call it.
There's decisions that need to be made.
So you have to still sit there and push the button to make sure it goes.
Oh, okay.
So you still need that as well.
Oh, I see. Okay. Got it. Yeah.
That goes, the automation is, in my opinion, super useful there, but even more important to do regression testing, which is making sure the things that already work stay working. We didn't break something that somebody already uses.
Right. Yeah. So that's another big piece of it as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Super helpful in terms of understanding what QA's role is versus the software engineers. But what about, let's talk about myths. Myths in QA. What are some of the top three, in your opinion, top three myths in about QA that just need to absolutely be squashed?
Well, the first one that immediately comes to mind is exactly what I was just talking about. That you can't have a bunch of software engineers QAing their own things. Like, we don't actually need a QA. We have a whole bunch of testing. Our developers write test scripts. They do their unit tests. They have an integration suite, all these different things that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And that's awesome.
Right.
I love that. I love working in organizations that have developers doing their own stuff like that. What you need is that first customer, which is, you know, one of the roles that QA kind of plays, is they're the first users. They're the first customers.
Yeah.
Which kind of leads to the second myth, is we're not there to be adversaries. People traditionally have seen it as an adversarial, like a confrontational role.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to lie, there are times I've kind of used that to my advantage. Where we get back to the credibility thing, there was a developer I worked with, and we got along very well. But when he'd see me walking up the hall and I'd have that smile on my face, he would turn right around into his office and lock the door. He's like, I don't want to hear this. I don't want to deal with this. So, but it's really just different sides of the same team.
Sure.
On a development team, you might have somebody who's really good at the back end. You have a front end developer. You have a person who's more of the project manager type. And the QA person is in charge of the tests and making sure the process is followed and understanding the impacts and the risks and identifying the risks.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, I don't want one of my lead developers. I do want them thinking about it, but I don't want that to be the forefront of their mind of what are the risks of doing this. I want them to think of the solution and start doing the solution.
Yeah.
And that the rest of the team backs it up. I don't even care if QA does the actual tests themselves in an agile environment. I'm just as happy if the QA person writes up a bunch of tests, runs about half of them, but other developers run some of those test cases too, not on their own code. I would not have you run tests against stuff you had developed. I'd have, you know, one of your teammates code. I'd have you do some of that.
Sure.
And so I'd much rather be, have more of it's a buzzword, but a synergy as part of the organization and the team.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons why, I don't like working for QA organizations that report to the development manager.
Ah, okay. So in your case, you said you report to the CTO.
I report to the CTO. In other organizations, I have reported to the development managers.
Mm-hmm.
One time that was fine and it was wonderful because she knew the right way to do these things and to sort of let me have my free reign of doing my job. The one that I left Nortel about, though, for example, I reported to him. He was one of the development managers.
Mm-hmm.
And we were supposed to ship in 4 days. It was a negotiated deadline, and there were goals set around it and things like that. I found a critical bug on Monday that would have been really bad for our customers to get.
Mm-hmm.
And I filed it. And my boss came to me and said, are you sure you really want to file this critical severity bug now?
Mm-hmm.
Because by doing so, you are going to affect everybody's bonus on your team and the organization. And started coming at me that way and trying to shape how I was doing my job to the benefit of the development team.
Mm-hmm.
That's an extreme example. But that's the kind of conflict of interest that can come about. I've also worked with development folks who, I walked out of an interview actually at one point because the VP of engineering said, I just kind of view QA as sort of this necessary evil, like a checkbox marketing makes us have. I'm like, we are not going to get along, dude. I'm not going to waste your time. I'm not going to waste my time.
Sure. Yeah.
Those are the two biggest ones that are very related to each other.
Right.
And the third one is like I also mentioned that it's only testing. It isn't only testing. There's a lot of other things that go along with it. There's assessment. And it's a really good place to start to learn how software companies work. I've had a lot of people come through my teams that went into project management, or they went over to development, or they went into some other product or something along those lines.
Right.
Because if your team is being run right, you're touching all of these areas of the process and you're interacting with everybody.
You have to, because you have to have that big picture view of what's going on.
And I'd much rather have somebody in the support team come to one of my QA engineers to talk about a problem that a customer's having than go bother the developer who's working on his next stuff and say, okay, maybe we can figure out exactly what's going on here. Maybe it's a user problem. Maybe it's just a communications thing. And then we can file the bug and go through the process that way.
Right.
And
that could be because people don't always understand what the role QA is doing. Right. So who do I ask? Oh, I ask the developer. They're the one that wrote it, right?
Right. and it's tough too, because there's so many things in the industry revolve around KPIs and various metrics. There is only one metric that counts for QA, and it's how many critical issues are out in the world.
Yeah.
Whether you're a website and it's in production, or you're selling software applications for local install, how many of those customers are having pain?
Yep.
That you should have fit. You should have caught. Mm-hmm. That's the only metric that counts for me. I have yet to encounter a QA metric I can't game.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that one.
So
there's an old Dilbert cartoon about a $10 bonus for every bug found and fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And the punchline is, I'm going to go write me a minivan. It's super easy to game a lot of these metrics.
Sure.
And because it's not the same as development, it's not, there's a lot more abstract to it.
Yeah.
Or at least there should be. It's harder to get accurate metrics.
All right. Got it. So we're going to move to the last question now. We have a few more minutes. This is the question that I ask all of my podcast guests.
Okay.
And that is, what is the biggest people-related challenge in your job?
Well, being a misanthrope. actually, I'll be honest. I alluded to it before. It's getting people to work within that environment, whether it's your QA people or the people that you're dealing with outside, to get past that adversarial approach. Or, you know, I've run into an awful lot of really, really good developers who have an ego problem being told that they're making mistakes by somebody who doesn't even know how to write their own code.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that challenge there. There's also I take this challenge on myself. I kind of enjoy it, but it is a super huge challenge, is taking people who might not have the level of confidence to go up against somebody like that. And I don't like using that term because it goes back to my adversarial thing.
Sure.
But being able to have that conversation and hold their own and convince somebody that this is really a problem, how to build up their own credibility and their own confidence around that in an environment that can be hostile to them.
Right.
But I go back to that original thing that I learned. I mean, I learned when I was 14 years old, learning how to be a patrol leader in Scouts, is find those skills that those people have, work on those, bring those strengths out, utilize those to build up the confidence that then they can work on some of their areas they're not as strong in and build those as well.
Yeah.
So I I definitely jump into that. I try to get the team going on things. And I also am very realistic. I say to them, look, this has gotten me in trouble too. So this is a job. I love working with you. I would love to have you here. But, and this was a hard lesson for me. The first time I got laid off, it was super hard for me to learn this lesson, is this will not be your job forever, probably. Mm-hmm. I want to help you grow. I want to help you be better at your job here. But at the same time, I want you to just be a better engineer. And when that time comes that you find a great opportunity, I will write you the reference letter.
Right.
And I have done that.
Yes.
At the same time, however, I've also had three boomerangs in my career where people have left the company and come back to work for me.
Uh-huh.
So I think that my approach generally works.
Mm-hmm.
But it is super challenging because I also have to be the one that gets up there and has to convince them to stand up in front of everybody and tell them the mistakes they made, tell them they suck, and have them thank them afterwards.
Right, to be the model for that.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. And also just stand your ground on things. That's hard to do when you're dealing with engineers sometimes.
Absolutely.
But also it's just, you know, being that voice of not contrarianism, but being that voice of, is this the right thing to do? Or why are we doing this? That's hard to do and hard to develop. And I think that's probably my biggest challenge.
Yeah.
In this field. I generally get along fairly well with people. And even the ones I don't get along with, I get along with as much as I need to.
Right. Sure.
I've stuck with smaller companies for the larger portion of my career because mm-hmm. I don't have the patience for that sort of politics and the phoniness and things like that. I just like to be direct, you know, friendly. I'd like, you know, I get more stuff done at the bar at 5:30 after work a lot of times.
Yeah.
Talking with a development manager or something like that. Go out, grab a beer and have those conversations. You can't do that in the larger companies.
That's right.
It's hard, much harder to do.
Yep.
So I worked in a place that had super Microsoftian vertical communication paths. To talk to this guy, I had to talk to my manager who talked to his manager to make sure it was okay with the other guy's manager that he and I talked.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the patience for that.
Yeah.
Which, and the politics behind it, which is ironic considering the 7 years I spent at Blue State
Digital. I was going to say that. Yeah. It is very ironic saying you don't want to deal with the politics, but yeah.
There's a difference between the political landscape of a campaign and office politics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's the difference there.
Yeah. And I think you touched on a really important point of leadership, which is building confidence and being able to do that, building the confidence of your team. But in order to do that, you need to be continually working on that yourself.
Ideally, I can drop off the face of the earth and the team still runs exactly the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that it's ideal that I drop off, but I mean, if tomorrow I got this phenomenal role that I had to move out to California for or something like that,
right,
I could go and the team would hardly notice a difference.
Right, because you've led them to the point of being self-sufficient. Able to do that.
Yeah. I know they're smarter than me. I know they're better than I am at these things. You have to bring that out.
Absolutely. That's leadership.
That's what I try to do anyway.
Yeah. Awesome. And on that point, I think that's a great way to end up our conversation today, Joe. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. It's been great chatting.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. You're welcome. All right. I was just going to check to see how long we ended up being.
At least I didn't talk about my problems with Rob.